Welcome to Rethinking Wellness, a podcast and Substack newsletter that offers critical thinking and compassionate skepticism about wellness and diet culture and reflections on how to find true well-being. I'm your host, Christy Harrison. I'm a health journalist, a registered dietitian specializing in disordered eating, and the author of three books, including Anti-Diet, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, and The Wellness Trap, which was the inspiration for this podcast. If you like what you hear, become a paid subscriber to get all our content at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Hey there. Welcome to this episode of Rethinking Wellness. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and my guest today is Liz Bukar, a religious ethicist and professor of religion at Northeastern University, and the author of the new book, Beyond Wellness. We had a fascinating conversation about the religious roots of wellness practices, why she argues bringing religion back into spiritual wellness spaces might be the key to promoting true well-being, even for non-religious people like her and me, and how the very human need for control shows up in diet and wellness culture, including in the massive spreadsheets of biohackers like Brian Johnson. And then for paid subscribers, we do a deeper dive into how religion has contributed to Americans' troubled relationship with food, and how religious foodways can also help us heal from diet culture, with some detours into the longevity movement, GLP-1s and the thin ideal, and lots more. To hear the whole thing, plus get lots of other great perks, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. If you do, you'll not only get to hear extended interviews like this one, but you'll also get subscriber-only Q&As and essays, full access to the archives, commenting privileges and a place to connect with other listeners, and more. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com to sign up or click the link in the show notes. And thanks so much to everyone who's already a paid subscriber. I truly couldn't do this work without your support, which means so much to me. Paid subscribers get to hear this episode ad-free, and everyone else will get to Liz Bukar after these messages. Liz Bukar, welcome to Rethinking Wellness. I'm so excited to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited too.
You've written a book with a fascinating thesis, which is that we need to bring the religious roots back to wellness practices, even if we ourselves are not religious. And I'm not, so I was really interested to read this book in light of that. But before we dive into the book, I'd love to just hear a little bit about your background and especially your experiences with wellness and diet culture.
Oh, okay. So let me start a little bit my background in terms of like why I wrote this book and why I talk about religion, and then I'll talk about my background in wellness and diet culture. Okay, that's like a whole other bucket. So I'm a professor of religion, so I have a PhD in religion, but I came to the study of religion as always kind of an outsider. I actually came from nonprofit social justice work in DC, and I was working on reproductive health, particularly in Latin America. I'd lived in Brazil as a kid, and so I had this real interest in Latin America and women's health. And if you're interested in reproductive health in South America, the Catholic Church is a player. Like, it's not something you can kind of be like, oh, they don't matter. They're just a super important cultural institutional player. So I got interested in religion as sort of like, oh, if I want to do this advocacy, religion is part of like the equation. I have to know, understand these religious institutions and the religious teachings. And that's why, that's like when I went off to grad school, that's what I was thinking of. Not so much that religion was a problem or an obstacle, but maybe it could be a resource to NGO work. But myself at that point, like I had no religious affiliation. So it wasn't like I went as, you know, to do like a ministry degree. But, and then I think most of my career, I became a comparativist, meaning I studied many religions and, you know, did field work in Iran and Turkey and Indonesia. I did a lot of work on Islam. Learned Persian and Arabic, sort of became more like an anthropologist of religion. I'd go in and embed myself in communities and do interviews and do focus groups, but always, again, kind of as an outsider, really interested in ethics and norms and values. And then I think because maybe this is like a midlife thing, but as I've gotten to this point in my life, I realize, I'm kind of reflecting on like all that work and thinking and working with religious communities, even though I don't have religious affiliation and I'm not really looking for one or planning to get one. I still, I think as I realize that like my my worldview has changed because of this. Like, it changes how I interpret what's going on, what I see going on, and also how I want to respond. And so this book, Beyond Wellness, comes out of, like you, I don't have religious affiliation, I don't consider myself religious, but comes out of all that work and teaching and research that had me sort of see that, like, oh my God, there's all this embedded logic in wellness culture that no one's really paying attention to. That's a little bit icky that I want to, like, you know, uncover. And then also the religious traditions, if you kind of go past, like, you know, mainstream white Protestantism, Christian nationalism, the other forms of religion and religious communities have some resources to push back and help me think about what does, like, real well-being look like beyond what I've been sold as wellness. And then in terms of what you asked about, like, my interactions with wellness culture and diet culture. So wellness culture, just broadly, so I'm 52, so I've been sold wellness culture most of my life in sort of very gendered terms, right? That I, whether or not that's perfection, right? Whether or not that's about beauty or thinness, or particularly recently longevity. As a midlife woman, you know, everyone's worried about my bone density, and apparently all the cardio I was told to do my entire life was, like, ruining my cortisone levels. I should have been lifting heavy the whole time. You know, so there's all this, like, health advice I feel like I've been fed my entire life. I am that, you know, person that the Goop algorithm targets. I feel like Gwyneth Paltrow is, like, you know, all over my feed kind of thing. And I think that I have, so my reaction to that as someone who's now in their midlife is, like, I was just being sold a bunch of stuff that in some ways didn't work or didn't give me what it promised, but also was too low of a bar. Like, I want something beyond whatever hitting those markers that I was being told to hit. And I want to push back against some of that idea of, like, feminized perfection that is just not really about my flourishing. So that's, like, a general reason for the book. And then diet culture, I mean, we'll probably get into this, but I just found it interesting. Like, I have never had a diagnosed eating disorder. But I was sort of thinking, like, I don't really know any woman who has not always had diet culture affect them negatively in some way, right? It's always like I think we're always dancing with the edges, even if you don't have disordered eating, dancing with the edges of, well, you know, how do you consume food? How do you restrict food? I think about food too much, because I think that women just are, particularly women, are targeted with diet culture. So I have grown up in, you know, the 80s and 90s and got fed all that toxic diet culture junk. And then I think, you know, even now, I mean, the part of this is family. Like, I, you know, my mother talks a lot about food and body size. My grandmother did as well. She moralized body size. But then more closely related to me, and I do talk about this in the book, which is why I feel okay talking about on podcasts, is I have, like, the closest women in my life have all had a diagnosed eating disorder, by which I mean my two sisters, my sister-in-law, and my teenage daughter. And I wrote this book. In fact, I edited the chapter about eating when she was hospitalized, which is just very fresh while I'm writing it and still very fresh for her. She's still in recovery. I'm looking for someone who hasn't been touched at all. But even when I say I don't have a eating disorder, it's certainly part of my life. I grew up one sister who passed out in high school kind of thing, classic sort of anorexic, another sister who was bulimic for a long period of time and nobody knew. And then my sister-in-law didn't come out about it until recently, like when I was writing this book and she read a version of this chapter or wrote about eating. It was like, I just want you to know. So, you know, I'm kind of in it with everybody trying to figure out our way through what eating well looks like and what real wellness looks like and how food can be more than something that I need to control or restrict or track or whatever, and how it can be about community and savoring and, you know, coming together. And I actually think that religions, and we'll get into that, I think that religions have some resources to offer us on that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's such an interesting thesis. And, you know, to your point about everyone you know being touched by it, I think I too have had the same experience. I mean, I had an eating disorder myself that was not diagnosed. And then, you know, about a decade of disordered eating having grown up as an intuitive eater, having grown up not really touched by it, but having people around me certainly, you know, have severe struggles with eating disorders. Even, and you know, many of my friends I didn't know at the time were struggling, including some of my punk rock alternative friends in high school who, you know, from the outside seemed like they weren't trying to adhere to any sort of beauty ideal or something like that. And, you know, in fact, we're doing the antithesis of it, right? But then actually secretly behind the scenes were struggling with their own internalized beliefs about how their bodies should look and what they should eat and what was good and bad and all of that stuff. So, you know, it definitely was around me at all times. And, you know, my mom was not a severe dieter, but certainly was always talking about wanting to lose a little bit of weight.
Yeah, and, exactly. Same.
Right. Those last X pounds or whatever from the baby or whatever it was. And, you know, just eating a little bit less than the rest of us. And I definitely clocked that at a certain point, that she would serve herself less or that she would leave some things off her plate. And that the purpose of that, you know, that wasn't just because she didn't like them or she wasn't hungry that night or something, but it was that she was looking to change her body. So all of that was like swirling around me as I grew up. And the, you know, as soon as I gained a little bit of weight, because I had all this thin privilege when I was growing up and people made fun of me for being able to eat whatever I wanted and stay thin and all this stuff. And at a certain point in college, I gained a little bit of weight and then it was just right there. All of that diet culture messaging was right there in my mind, like ready to go. And I fell pretty quickly into disordered eating and what would have been diagnosable as an eating disorder if anyone had caught it. But, you know, for various reasons, nobody did. And I was fortunate to be able to kind of pull back from that edge quickly as a result of many things that I've talked about before. But yeah, it just, you know, it does, I think, touch us all in some way. And it's really
that's
interesting.
So annoying to me. The more I like realize that, I'm like, there's not really any woman I know who's not.
And increasingly men too, you know, like, or people of any gender, really. Like, I think people just, there's different ways that it's presented in different cultures, different genders, but it touches us all in some way. And it's really insidious.
My neighbor is actually, so she's an adolescent health. She's actually in the practice, the same practice that my daughter saw, you know, the basically her boss in her practice. But she mostly treats young boys. She's like, that's, you know, we're, and it's not anorexia, right? It's more the like, the anxiety around eating. So very, very, very narrow amounts of food that they, I forget what the it begins with an A.
Is it ARFID? Yeah.
Yeah, ARFID. Sorry. Yeah, thank you. And then how very common that is becoming and probably way underdiagnosed, you know, previously with boys. Like, oh, he's just a picky eater. And that anxiety is showing up. So, yeah, I think about it as gendered because I have a partner who is, who still present, like he is like you were in high school, right? He's very intuitive eater, eats what he wants to. He's been the exact same size forever and never has felt that noise or that judgment or whatever that, you know, that shame or, you know, we're going to talk about that, right? All the different ways in which diet culture has done us dirty.
I know it's so problematic. And yeah, let's definitely get into that. I want to talk all about how diet culture shows up in wellness spaces and the sort of religious underpinnings of it as well, because you have a really fascinating section about that. But I think before we get there, I want to talk about some other things that you highlight in the book that are really interesting, because the central questions that you ask in your words are, if we ignore the religious context and content of our spiritual techniques, are they missing their special sauce? Could they be even more powerful if we added the religion back in? Is there a way to do so without joining a religious community or declaring a religious identity? I thought that was really interesting just as a way to frame this whole exploration of wellness practices, whether it's yoga, meditation, food, or various other things. What made you start to ask these questions?
Yeah, I guess I think I was starting to realize that a lot of the stuff, I mean, this is like my religion nerd brain turning on. I was realizing a lot of stuff I was getting sold in the wellness spaces, first of all, had there were techniques that were getting plucked from, you know, particularly indigenous and in Asian religious and cultural communities and being kind of packaged as like, oh, there's this new thing. I was like, well, it's not that new. But also, don't worry, because it's not religion. So you know, it's spirituality. So partly this is like a branding issue, right? I realize things are being called spiritual or wellness practices because people don't like the word religion. They don't like religion for good reasons, right? I say religion has a PR problem and it's well deserved. You know, there are people who are deconstructing high control upbringings in religious communities. There are, you know, politics of Christian white nationalism. There are, for my students, I know a big thing for them is LGBT issues within some religious communities, like not line up with their core values. So, like, there's a lot of institutions in general. People don't like institutions. They don't like religious institutions. They don't like the idea of hierarchy or clergy. So things were kind of, I felt like I was getting marketed stuff that to me looked like watered down, but also just out of context practices. So no longer a community, no longer an ethical framework, no longer a history, no longer the metaphysics, no longer the stuff that, like, just the practice, just the technique, like, just do this thing. Don't worry about it. Just do the sound bath. Like, don't worry about it. Just do the yoga because it's so wise and ancient and it'll help fix you. You know, and I do all that stuff. Like, I'm in all that stuff. I am not, this is not an anti-wellness book. Like, I do all these things, right? It made it very easy for, like, I am a certified yoga teacher, right? Like, I do all this stuff. And I like all this stuff, but I just sort of realized that, you know, the yoga classes that I like the most start to feel more devotional. And when, you know, I get the more out of religion, more out of yoga, the more I sort of know some of this context. So that was part of it, like me trying to think about, well, if psychedelics are your thing, what about psychedelics in a religious container would make psychedelics work better for you and maybe come with less risk and maybe be more aimed at the collective and the community, because a lot of wellness culture is like focused on the individual. It just, you know, like as if we can like be well alone, you know, this in isolation. That's not how it works. And then also I'm just, because I'm interested in ethics and norms and values, that like, the central value of the wellness industry is sort of just self-optimization, whether or not that's beauty or thinness or longevity or whatever, peak performance at work. But that's for me, again, that's like just too narrow of a view of like fully human flourishing. Like, what does that look like? And what does it mean to show up and be a good person in community? And what does it mean to be, what can some of these practices do to reinforce those ideas I have about what it means to have a good life? That's part of where the book comes from. But I do know it's a little bit of uphill battle. I mean, that quote that you just read is a good example, because my students, for example, they like the spiritual practices. They're really drawn to them. They're intrigued by either if they're exotic or they think they might be nice, like quick fixes, or not even the quick fixes, like they're willing to put in the work, but they don't want to get involved in the mess of religion. And I actually think that it's wrong that you're safe just because you're doing a spiritual practice and not a religious practice. There's all kinds of bad abuse that can happen in a spiritual community, right? For example, or a wellness community. I think we're seeing a little bit of the death of the wellness guru, the spiritual guru. We're a little bit, that jig is up. Maybe we shouldn't be so scared of the religion. Like, I just think there was a lot of stuff left behind to make these things more digestible to your average non-religious American, for example. And some of that stuff that made it more digestible could be stuff that you would find valuable. It, not a one-size-fits-all, right? Maybe some stuff works for you and doesn't work, other stuff doesn't. But there's a lot left on the table when we just took the physical practice, for example, and did it. Or we just took this one idea about food and eating and applied it to diet culture without some of the more of the framework there.
Yeah, totally. I'm of two minds about this. And it was really interesting to sort of grapple with this idea as I read your book, because I think you made a lot of great points about the importance of like the ethics and the sort of morality aspect of religion being stripped away, and how that like can kind of inherently make it more of an individualistic pursuit, right? And takes people out of community and community-mindedness. And so I think that's really important. But then I also think about my experience of yoga, because I've been practicing yoga now for like, I don't know, 20 years, something like that, which started in a gym. You know, it started as like, I was going to physical therapy. I was having a lot of back pain and problems. And my physical therapist prescribed all these exercises that I just did not want to do and found really like onerous to do on my own. And then I thought, well, you know, some of these are kind of, I had taken like one yoga class in college and I knew a little bit about yoga. And I was like, you know, some of these are sort of like yoga poses, and maybe I can just go to a yoga class and like use that as my physical therapy. And I tried it and it helped my back a lot. And so I just kept going. And, you know, then I moved to a place that was away from that gym. And I was like, well, if I want to keep practicing yoga or doing yoga, as I was, you know, thinking of it at that point, like I wanted to, I had to join a yoga studio. And so I did. And it happened to be a Jiva Mukti yoga studio. And I started to like get sort of into that world and took a lot of these classes that had more of the religious lineage kind of woven in, I think. And I, you know, I don't know a ton about Jivamukti even still, but as opposed to some other lineages, but I know that there was a lot of devotional aspects to it. And there's also a really strong sort of push towards veganism, and that that's kind of central to that style of yoga. And to me at the time, who was struggling with an eating disorder, it was like really difficult and problematic to be hearing all of that stuff. Cause it, you know, I didn't ultimately go vegan, but I did bring in, you know, I sort of felt guilty about eating animal products and would try to and then not be able to. And so, you know, it sort of added to this pressure that I was feeling and this layering on of like different diet rules that was a characteristic of my eating disorder. And I think many other people's eating disorders where it's like, you know, you sort of just take bits and pieces from all the diets you've ever tried and those just stack up in your mind. And so you're like, well, I'm supposed to be doing this, but also I really shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, you just kind of get painted into a corner, right? And so for me, like, I think the sort of ethics of it was really beautiful in some way about thinking about non-harming and the mark we leave on the world and the way that we sort of affect others, other beings. And it was also just sort of dovetailed with a lot that was going on for me at the time that was really tricky. It got very tangled up with the eating disorder, I think. So I'm curious, you know, to hear your thoughts on like, how can we engage in some of the more, and, you know, and this is also like, I'm a white woman, right? I'm totally not for, and I, and a non-religious, like lifelong non-religious white woman. I have some Jewish heritage, but I've never practiced any religion. And so like, you know, how is it that I ended up there in that, you know, and then, and for a while was considering myself kind of Buddhist and, you know, doing some Buddhist meditation and stuff as well. But just, you know, that is another problematic layer to it. So yeah, I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that, that piece of like, how can we think about bringing in religious practices or the, some of the more like the actual religious aspects to these practices that we might think of as just wellness in a way that is also honoring where we're coming from, especially for people with disordered eating, because I know a lot of folks listening are in that boat.
Yeah. Okay. So that second part is interesting. I haven't thought about that before. So one thing to note, the book I wrote before this book was a book about cultural appropriation of religion. So the book was called Stealing My Religion. And there's also a chapter about yoga in that chapter, in that book. So, you know, thinking about that book was a lot about thinking about harms that we, that happen because of our entitlement and privilege that we hold as white women and, you know, yoga studios that are places of white, maintaining white privilege or civility or not politicized or, you know, just spiritual bypassing, all kinds of problematic things. And then this book was more like, okay, that's, I see that. I've leaned into my like guilt about that. So where do we go from there? And so we just take the example of yoga. I mean, I basically do this with every single practice, and there's seven different practices in this book, everything from, like you said, yoga and mindfulness to AA, eating, exercise, and psychedelics. But if we just stick with like yoga, so part of this, in every case, I think part of what adding, say, say devotional aspects, and if the word religion makes you itchy, is partly finding a community or a teacher that is practicing in a way that I think lines up with your core values in somewhere, what you want to get out of it, what you want to learn from, so that you're not doing this on your own. There is like not one answer to how to make, you know, yoga more devotional or more make it look more religious. So I'm not like, this book isn't about like, there is this essence, this authentic essence. And if you reach back this many years and do exactly this, because yoga itself is this dynamic, always in flux, you know, practice. And it's not based in one religion. It arises within this sort of matrix of many religions in the South Asia and the Asian context. But, you know, just if we stick with like one little piece, right? Like say we wanted to stick with ethics and we want to think about values and norms and how could we make our yoga practice not just heal our backs. And I should say, I also started yoga because of my back. My mom was a yoga teacher back when before that was cool. You know, she was one of these like OG white yoga teachers before that was anything anybody did. And so I'd seen yoga, but I didn't do it myself until I had a back injury from rowing in college. And it also helped heal me physically. But if we wanted something more than just physical healing, like if we started going a lot and we realized, wow, this is like really doing something cool to my central nervous system, or I'm really finding a time to reflect. And then we can start thinking about how yoga fit into this larger devotional practice of that had many different like limbs and many different things that people were doing. And it was a physical practice, like most of these physical practices that I look at, that was meant to remake you into a certain kind of person. So all that like other stuff that was going on around yoga, observations, restraints, some of the ethics, for example, ethical framework, or some of the meditative stuff, and the yoga postures were not just meant to like heal your back and heal your body, but they were ways to kind of change who you are. And so thinking about yoga that way, if you do it within a community or with a teacher, how am I trying to like use this practice also to remake myself? And I like to start with a kind of very simple example, because people have heard of it before, the yamas and niyamas. So these are the restraints and the things you shouldn't do and the things that you should do according to sort of the eight limbs of yoga, Patanjali's eight limbs. I don't mean that you should go back and read these ancient texts and find out what their lists are. I mean, for my students, for example, I'm like, what is your list? Like, if you putting your like your mat aside for a second, what's the list of things that you would like to make sure you're doing and things you're not doing? So like non-harm is a good example, right? That comes up in the classic texts. What does non-harm look like to you? What does moderation, this is probably the trickiest one for people with food, right? So moderation in the classic text is about, you know, sexual moderation. Often it gets talked about in terms of moderation in some yoga studios. It's more about food and stuff. But moderation doesn't have to mean restriction. It can also mean, you know, abundance or, you know, freedom or intuition or whatever for eating. So I think it's like this, taking that extra step to be like, okay, well, what are my list of observations and my list of restraints? What are my yamas? What are my niyamas? What are my things I want to be doing more in my life and or things I want to be doing less in my life? And then how can I, you know, reflect on those, brainstorm those, journal about those? And then maybe when the yoga teacher asks you to do that, set the intention in the beginning of class, and everyone kind of rolls their eyes usually, right, or whatever. But like actually use that at a time. Like today, I'm going to think about this thing from my list, and I'm going to use my practice and my breath work to like imprint this value on me. And I'm going to come out afterwards when I'm in that, you know, that great like post-yoga bliss. And I'm going to try not to be so reactive to my kid, for example, right? Or I'm going to try to think about what moderation might look like in this aspect of my life, in terms of whatever, checking email or social media, whatever it is. So I think it's just that extra layer of like, not just doing the physical practice that you were told is a thing that will make you well, but also thinking about what that physical practice did in a bigger container and context. And could you also do that practice in that way, that in a way that fits into your life and who it is that you're trying to become? It's a little theoretical what I just explained, but that's just kind of an example of what I mean when I say I'm not trying to like give you like, here's the romanticized, ancient, authentic, pure version of what yoga needs to look like for it to be proper, right? I just think that there's all kinds of different ways of linking yoga, the physical practice of yoga, the asanas, to the bigger practice of yoga, so that we're not just working on self-optimization or a good yoga butt or healing our back. Healing our back is important. Great. I love that. I love mobility. I was actually just thinking I should be doing yoga more often than I am because I've been weightlifting so much. I'm kind of getting stiff. Like all those physical things are important. It's just like, it's just a floor, not a ceiling of what I think the yoga can do for people who can really want to dive into it and whatever aspects that they find interesting.
Well, yeah. And I think about my own evolution with it, where it started off with back pain. But I think for me, the back pain and a lot of it was holding and gripping and tightness, you know, throughout my body, right? In various places that my back was taking on a lot that was, it shouldn't have been taking on because of other places that were so tight and like overworked, and overexercise was a big part of my life at that point too.
Right. There's your moderation, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And starting to practice yoga was like a step away from that. And, you know, when I did it at first, I would like do other things at the gym too. And my yoga teacher would see me afterwards, be like, you know, you're always working, huh? You know, like, and, you know, over time, I kind of moved away from that and started to realize, I think it was like the experience of relaxing into my body and like opening up things that were tight and allowing my movement to be more gentle and not push myself to the degree I was, started to help me do that in other aspects of my life as well. Right. And it started to inherently kind of spill off the mat into my life.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of like holistic, like, yeah, beyond the asana, beyond the physical practice that I sort of, yeah, that was sort of thinking about. And that idea of like, what would it mean to like allow that ease in different parts of your life? And, you know, so I love a hot yoga class. I'm not going to pretend like I don't love a hot yoga class, but like there was a period of my life where all I wanted to do was classes that were like in 95 degrees. And then, you know, you come out and you're dizzy and it's like, great, I'm dizzy. I must have done it well. And that's the kind of yoga class, you know, my 18-year-old kid really likes. But then like, you know, really... It's 95 degrees outside today in Brookline. I do not need to go to a hot yoga class, right? So what do I need physically and, you know, emotionally, and if you want to say spiritually, you know, and mentally, whatever, and what would that look like? And there are a lot of different things that yoga can offer beyond that, like power, flow, aggressive, athletic. My mom, when I started doing that, my mom's like, oh, that's not yoga. Because to her, yoga was like what she did on a braided rug in her living room every morning. And it was that like softening and relaxing and quiet time and reflective time in a different kind of way. So there's like a range of different ways different physical practices can do different things. But I love the way you put that. Like, you know, you sort of discovered, again, that value of moderation in the physical practice itself. And then what does that mean for moderation in other parts of your life?
Yeah. And that word moderation, which can feel so like tricky when it comes to food, really can feel, when I think about the moderation that I needed at that time, it was like to just ease up, you know, ease up on my eating, ease up on my exercise, ease up on like the you know, and what by ease up on my eating, I mean, ease up on the restrictions, ease up on all the rules I had for myself, like let myself just be and enjoy and take pleasure in food.
Right. And the perfection, maybe the macros aren't perfect today. I'm starting to hear more advice actually from nutritionists and sort of fitness and wellness influencers, even on Instagram, that like that strictness and that restriction itself is counterproductive. You know, also like you're undernourishing yourself, you're underfeeding yourself, then your body is reacting problematically to that as well, versus living in some ease for yourself, but then also just for the rest of your life, right? I like the example of like, or I don't like the example, rather, of Brian Johnson, like talking about his, and I'm sure listeners all know who he is, but he's, you know, one of these tech bros who's spending $2 million a year trying to like live forever and has also started a religion where he himself is sort of the center of it. But he, one thing he says he does is he stops eating 11 o'clock every day, every morning.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine, like, you don't eat lunch and dinner with anybody ever. Like, just socially what that does,
sad.
Right? Yeah, it's really sad. And so if Brian Johnson lives 10 years, I don't think he's going to make it more than 10 years longer than me, quite frankly. I have like longevity genes in my family. So, you know, everyone lives to be late 90s, 100. So maybe he makes an extra 10 years than me. But like what, but he lived 50 years like this, right? So thinking too about the good life is not the perfect life and giving up on that perfection of the perfect eating regime and the perfect physical regime and realizing that like the wellness industry has told us that the goal is perfection. They promise perfection, right? And that, but I think that like religious traditions and, you know, deeper philosophical traditions acknowledge that like that's not possible. Like human life, like we're vulnerable. We get sick. We have moments of friction. There are bad vibes and good vibes. You know, there's all kinds of emotions. And that, all of that, and it's messy and we die and all that stuff is part of the human, like the full human life and full flourishing. And like, I want it all. If I, you know, if Brian Johnson's here for another 50 years, I'm here for another 50 years. I think I can have a fuller life. And that's how I think about religion. They're my conversation partners. I'm trying to think past what tech bros are doing and past what Instagram is telling me in terms of wellness and longevity and perfection and whatever, and think about what a full human life looks like. So not just a long life, but a good life. And I don't mean just by good life, like a happy life, a content life, like a really, really fully human life. And I just think religious communities and thinkers and traditions have thought about that for a long time. So I just find them helpful for being like, hey, you know, have you thought about this or tried this kind of thing? So as a counter sort of a counterweight to what the cultural push is.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot about that a lot with the longevity push and people like Brian Johnson, who, you know, if you've seen that spreadsheet he has of like all of his labs or whatever and his supplements and all the things, it just feels very obsessive and compulsive. And, you know, I have those tendencies myself, and it's not something that I want to lean into that hard for the rest of my life. Like, that feels like it would just shut down so many other aspects of my life. You know, like, what do you have to give up to live like that? That's not for me, you know. And maybe for him and for people like that, I'm certain that there is some sort of sense of control and a pleasure that's derived from that, you know, and a sense of like being in charge of all of these things that feel so out of our hands, actually, much of the time, and that really still are. Even if you're tracking all of these metrics, you know, you could die in an accident, or there could be something that you're not tracking, or that you were tracking and you're taking supplements for, and yet it was actually doing the opposite of what you thought it was, right? And like, you know, I mean, I think about the previous longevity gurus who've died early. There's a long list of them, you know. Well,
I mean, I think it's helpful. I think it's also helpful to say, and to be honest, that I also have those tendencies. Like, I wear a wearable, and so I can see all this data about myself. And I find, for example, the sleep information very, very annoying and upsetting. Like, I know I'm not sleeping enough. But, you know, it tracks things, and I see myself being like, well, why is my pace of aging like this week versus last week? And, oh, I would like to be 9 years older, younger than I am, not, you know, seven, whatever, all this data, right? And you can just see how that data you can be obsessed about and obsessive. And so, you know, how much of that is useful for me figuring out that I'm not, it also has a recovery thing too, which is helpful to be like, today you should take it easy, you know? But like, how much of that I'm also drawn to is really actually just messing with my head. But the other thing you just said, and I think I also have this tendency, and I wanted to stop a moment, talk about this idea of control, because that was a huge theme that I was worked through in the book. And it came up, I mean, it comes up in every chapter, because I think that partly what religious worldviews do is push back on this idea, which is very attractive and very intoxicating, that we can master our own well-being, right? So if you have like a religion that were like a theism, right, where God is central to the whole thing, like, they're like, you're not in charge, God's in charge. But for me, so I think that in general, that's part of what putting things back in a religious container does, is it helps alleviate the idea of control and, I think, ultimately responsibility. Like, there's so much pressure we put on ourselves. And then, like, well, I got cancer, what did I do wrong? Like, no, these things happen, right? Like, it's not like, or I got dementia, maybe I should have been doing more puzzles when I was young. You know, all this stuff, we're blamed then for just like things that happen. You know, genetics happen, environment happens. But the chapter where that came up the most for me, and I don't even know if we were really going to talk about this, but it was the chapter about AA.
Yes, I was just thinking that, the higher power.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, this book is, I'm very vulnerable in this book. So I talk a lot about myself and my family. And that chapter is a lot about my dad, who has passed. He died of pancreatic cancer a couple of years ago. But he was an alcoholic, and he was an alcoholic for whom he could never work the AA program, because he just found it too God, like too much religion, right? Too much God talk, he'd say. And so I like sort of thought about that, like, what does it mean that we give a lot of people with addiction 12-step programs, or we offer them up something like AA, which often has, I mean, look, people, I know people say who are in AA that it's not religious, but it has religious origins. I mean, it just does. Like, it comes out of a Protestant framework. It comes out of something called the Oxford Group. The 12 steps are based on steps to avoid sin. Like, it's just, it's very, very, very Christian in its origins, and it's still in its language. And then also God and higher power is all over that program. So I try to think about, like, you know, I wish it had worked for my dad. What could have worked for my dad? What could work for me? And I say that as, like, for me, I don't mean that I struggle. I actually don't drink at all because my dad drank too much. But, like, again, is there a portable idea from AA that I can use even as a non-religious person? And I really wanted one, right? Like, I was like, I just got to find something here that would work. And I went to not AA meetings, but Al-Anon meetings, which are meetings for, you know, family and friends. And that what I realized is, like, the core insight, which is very religious, is not necessarily like, here is the higher power you have to believe in, here is the God you have to believe in. but you have to believe that you're not God. And that is actually huge. If you actually believe that you're not God, they're not in control. I have this like, this is my toxic trait. I think I can solve everything. I think I can fix things. I think I'm a fixer. So realizing that I'm not God and I can't solve my dad's addiction problem, right? Or I can't solve my kid's eating disorder, or the anxiety she feels about going to college, or my partner he's a federal employee. I can't solve that, you know, in this particular, I am not God. And to me, that is, whether or not the religion is theistic or not, the idea that we're not, like the idea of decentering humans and that we're not in control is a religious, there's an idea I see through every religious tradition I study. And that, I think if I can accept that, which I struggle with, that would make a huge difference in my life and my quality of life and my understanding of real well-being.
Oh my gosh, so many threads there that I would love to pull on. When you were talking about that, I'm like, it is really hard to sort of embrace the idea that I am not God when I don't believe in God, right? Like, I don't believe something out there is, do believe in the mystery. I do believe in, you know, that there is something going on beyond our control, that like pretty much everything is beyond our control. I do believe that. And yet I forget that on a near constant basis, you know, because I want to control and I want to have some order in my life. And especially with, I have had so many health issues and like, you know, I have become pretty anxious about health and a little bit obsessive. And, you know, I think part of the work I do, right, these like deep dives into the scientific research and that skill set that I've developed, being able to do that was partly from my own desire to like understand and control what was going on with me or what was going on for my clients, or, you know, to just have some semblance of like, at least get my head around it, even if I can't fix it, you know, like that maybe there was some sort of fix to be found in the literature. I think that was part of a drive to do that in the first place too. And now it's taken on its own life, but it's like, that's definitely still there, you know? Like this idea that, you know, we are not God is so important and profound. And like the idea that, you know, giving up our control to a higher power or whatever, but it's like, what is that higher power? I haven't quite figured that out for myself, I guess, in a way that makes it feel like I can totally relinquish the control, because I don't, you know, I don't believe in the traditional concept of God. I don't believe that it's an anthropomorphic sort of being. And so it's tough to, and I think that's probably what anthropomorphizing a deity can help do for us, maybe, is like to make it easier to relinquish control, to think, okay, this other creature has this.
There's a guy with a beard up in the cloud and he's looking
right
up for me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not to denigrate. And, you know, because I feel like that belief is so important to people and it's probably much more nuanced than that. But that is at a fundamental level, like, I just don't believe that there's a person or person like figure there.
I also have trouble with the idea of higher power. I'm jealous, not, it sounded like I was being flippant about the idea, but I'm very jealous of people who have a very strong sense of, like, you know, whatever that is, higher power or God, in sort of an Abrahamic sort of way, because I just think that it helps solve a lot some of these problems, right, in terms of control, and not that you're not responsible, but you're not completely irresponsible, and the idea of like hope. I've been thinking a lot about hope recently because of what's going on, and not even just politically, but yes, politically, but also environmentally, and also with the technology, and also, you know, just all the things, right? And how helpful it is for someone like my mom, who is Lutheran and pretty devout. She has a much greater developed sense of like trust and faith and hope in the future, because of her understanding of a higher power. And so I have trouble with higher power. It's like the one thing in religion that I, like, in terms of like the religion I was born into, Protestantism, that makes me not able to lean in. But I can get on board with I'm not God. That's like the first step for me. And then I find indigenous worldviews, like indigenous forms of religion /culture, really helpful for thinking about I'm not God without the idea of, you know, that sort of like Christian God, because it's more about, you know, it's decentering human agency, right? Not just even mine, but like, you know, it's so, Indigenous worldviews are so based on like place and space and nature and plants. Like plants are not just plants. They're like our ancestors, our kin. And like, that's such a very different version of my place or, you know, or other. So that's helpful for pushing me, but I have the same problem. Like I have trouble with the idea of higher power. But so my first step is not God. So that's all I'm working on. All I'm working on is I'm not God. And again, I don't believe in God. So why would I think I'm God? So for me, it's like an easier step, right? Like I don't believe in higher power. So I don't get to be
it's
it.
That's a good
right?
point. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why for me, I was like, okay, this is my epiphany. Like, yeah, I believe I'm not God because I don't believe in that concept of God. So I cannot be God. I cannot control. I cannot fix. It cannot be me if it's nothing, if I don't believe in it. So it, to me, it's like at least one portable idea from that AA chapter for me.
Yeah, that's huge. That's I'm going to sit with that for a while, I think, because that could be a key for me too. Okay, I want to now go a little deeper into one topic in a segment for paid subscribers because we got into some really interesting stuff about diet culture and control. And I want to now get into like how, as you put it, diet culture has religious roots, but also religious food ways can maybe help us heal from diet culture. But first, to wrap up the free portion of this episode, can you just tell listeners where they can find you and learn more about your work? And also say the title of the book, because I don't think we've said it yet.
The new book is called Beyond Wellness, How Restoring the Religious Roots of Spiritual Practices Can Heal Us. And you can buy that wherever you buy your books. If you go to my website, which is just my name, Liz Bucar, LizBucar.com, I have a page where it has links to all the places that you can buy the book in case you're, you know, you don't need to buy it at Amazon. It's available everywhere. And there's lots of information about me on my website. Another place to find me is I have a Substack called Religion Reimagined. And you can subscribe for free. I actually don't have anything paywalled. And there are my subscribers are pretty engaged. So I have very, very spicy comments on my posts. So, that is a, you know, sometimes I just have hundreds and hundreds of, the best stuff happens in the comments, I say. So that's another place to find me. Oh, and I'm also on Instagram, I guess, too. So if you're a social media person, I'm quite prolific on Instagram, and that's at Liz Bucar. So yeah, my name.
Thank you. We'll put links to all that in the show notes so people can find you too. And so now I want to ask you kind of as a starting point for this deeper conversation, how has religion contributed to Americans' troubled relationship with food? That's it for this free episode. To hear the deeper dive, upgrade to paid at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Thanks so much for listening and take care.